Do you like Joe Exotic, or are you on the crazy
I don't like
lady,
him.
The cat lady
but
side?
I don't like either. Carole Baskin either. I didn't like one person in that. Nobody.
I
nobody
will say
him.
This.
I like, the
I
guy
like
with no
Joe
legs.
Exotic's country music. I love his music.
Well, he's a fake. He's Milli Vanilli.
Yeah.
The guy I liked was the guy with no legs.
Yeah, he was a good too. Guy.
He seemed like a nice guy, genuine guy. You know, yeah. I see him.
Seemed like a decent guy. You really get to know him during the Tiger King documentary. Wow. Here's Bob McKenzie, our hockey insider. Are you a Tiger King guy, Bob?
Well, I watched the whole thing, and you guys are right. Every single person in there is just about the most objectionable human being you could possibly imagine.
Yeah. Adding 1,000 on unlikability.
And you're right. The dude with the prosthetics, he's okay. But I mean, at the end of the day, not the world's finest moment.
Well, Carole Baskin is in full blown panic mode apparently because Discovery Channel's gonna launch a documentary into her missing husband.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Baskin is starting to freak.
They're going to actually get some people that went to college to investigate it, and instead of those goons that were down there in Tampa Bay.
What?
Where is he? I don't know. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Hey, cool Tigers.
Yeah. Hey, where'd you get those Tigers? Oh, they were just back there. Okay, we'll chat later.
He still might come back. He's just on a business trip.
Yeah, they were selling that Costa Rica angle real hard.
I like what she said. Oh, he really liked Costa Rica, I guarantee. Yeah, he's down there.
He's looking for tigers.
My favorite part is when O said that husband of hers has been sleeping with one eye open for years. Oh.
Her new husband, he will never sleep a wink his whole life.
And the obvious thing, and I don't know anything about anything, I'm just watching this and I'm like, just shaking my head through the whole thing, and I'm like, and it didn't take very long to figure out that Carole Baskin seems to be guilty of all the same things as all the rest of those
idiots.
What a racket.
Yeah. You should put tigers on display.
Yeah, at the end of the day, she's still got tigers in cages, and I don't know, give me a break.
Yeah, it's not just, paying anyone. It was...
That's 7 hours of my life I'm never going to get back.
No, that's true.
Having said that, we're probably in a position to afford 7 hours right now. So
at this point, we've got a lot of hours to fill. So a little Tiger King never hurt.
Nope.
We brought this up, you know, periodically this afternoon. We haven't really gotten into it, and we're glad you're here because I think you can shed light on it better than anyone we know. This weekend marks the 30th anniversary of the passing of Harold Ballard. And we're not here to celebrate that. We're here to talk about his legacy and his tenure in Toronto. I am of the belief, correct me if I'm wrong here, or confirm or deny, Bob, Harold Ballard, the biggest, greatest villain in Maple Leaf history.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, you know, Stafford Smythe, who was Conn's son, you know, he ran into some legal issues, I think related, tax-related. And I think he did a stint somewhere other, but so did Harold. I mean, they didn't call him Millhaven Fats for nothing. That was his nickname for a while because he went away to the big house for some issues, if I'm not mistaken. I got to double check that, but I'm pretty sure. Anyways, Harold Ballard was unbelievable because he was highly entertaining. And completely volatile, unpredictable, and probably at the end of the day became, in the spirit of Tiger King, a somewhat objectionable human being. But boy, oh boy, the Ballard years were never dull. Now, the Leafs sucked badly through most of them, or a lot of them, and, you know, he just tormented poor Roger Neilson and Daryl Sittler. And the list goes on and on and on. But it was an event covering the Toronto Maple Leafs in the 1980s when Al Howell was around. I had a number of interesting exchanges with him. And I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, I remember the time women in the dressing room was a big, big issue. And he, of course, wouldn't permit it. And the league said, you have to let them in. And he goes, well, I'm not letting them in. It's my dressing room. I'm not doing it. And keep in mind, he was never afraid to stare the league down. And I think I saw on social media recently, somebody took a picture from a paper back then when the league mandated it, every team's got to put the names on the back of the sweaters. And he didn't want to do it. And so he very cleverly complied with the league directive, but he put blue letters on the blue sweater so you couldn't read it. So it would say Salmi on the back, but you couldn't actually see it.
Wow. What was he so pissed at that for?
Because he didn't want the expense. He didn't want the bother. He didn't want to be told what to do. So when the Leafs were their white jerseys, it was white letters, and you couldn't read those either. So that's the kind of guy he was. But anyways, I digress. So there was a particular night I remember where some of the female journalists, everybody wanted to get them into the dressing room, so everybody decided en masse that the entire crush of hockey writers would go in with the female media members in the middle and just basically storm through the dressing room and make sure. And if I remember correctly, because I got to be careful, there was a couple of nights when Harold went a little crazy. But that happened that night, and he went nuts. And at the time, I believe he had a cane, and he was trying to swing it at people and was swearing and cursing like you wouldn't believe at the women and just about everybody else. But that was not an unusual occurrence. And then there were stories, the great stories, and he had his girlfriend, I believe her name was Yolanda.
Yep.
And there were stories written that in the middle of the night, Harold and Yolanda would ride around the Zamboni in various states of undress at Maple Leaf Gardens just for the hell of it. So make of that what you will.
Wow.
That's a gotcha.
If any of that stuff, like when I think about that now, and it was crazy, every day was an adventure, and probably the best guy to get on to talk about Harold, because he had so many more interactions with him, would be Dave Hodge.
Right.
You know, because Dave Hodge used to do the midweek games, and I believe it was on, I want to say it was on CHCH, and the midweek Leaf games. Back in the old days, you only got one midweek Leaf game and the Saturday night game, and that was it. And they used to have, a post-game show on those Wednesday night games, and it was with Dick Bettos from the Globe and Mail. This really flamboyant guy, and he had crazy hats and crazy suits, and like crushed velvet suits and bowler hats and whatever. And he was quite a personality and was really off the wall. But he would say outrageous things, and, of course, Dave would tweak him and get him going a little bit, and a lot of it was going after Harold. And I think there were some nights where Harold actually physically tried to unplug the cable from the TV truck so they were off the air. But Dave would have lots of Harold Ballard stories, as would a lot of the other guys that covered the Leafs back in the 70s, late 70s and into the 80s. But he was a unique individual, and he and King were fixtures in the Ballard bunker right down at the end there.
Right.
Just above one of the nets. Good story on Harold, too, sitting in the bunker. Might have been in the pregame warm-up, I think. Chicago Blackhawks were in town. And Bobby Hull cranked a slap shot, and it missed the net. And it went right over the glass, and it went right into the bunker and hit Harold right in the face.
No way.
And, just blew his face right up.
Wow.
And King was so revered and beloved. And Harold was such a villain, and yet they were like peas in a pod, two superheroes, one bad guy and one good guy, that were like best pals. So it was pretty funny stuff.
Well, he was affiliated with the team forever, like from 1957, I think, all the way up until 90.
Would have been a director, yeah. And then when Stafford, I don't remember all the details, but I believe when Stafford Smythe got into trouble, Harold kind of squeezed in there, and Johnny Bassett was kind of in there at the time, the John Bassett Sr., not John Bassett Jr. Those were unusual times to be a Toronto Maple Leaf fan. I always joke that I always tell people I do speaking engagements, or people ask me, are you a Leaf fan? And I go, no, I'm not. I said, I grew up a Leaf fan. Grew up, Scarborough, Ontario kid in the 1960s, Punch 'Em Like Leafs, Tim Horton, Davey Keogh, the Big M, those were all my guys, and I was a huge Leaf fan. in the 1960s, and they go, why aren't you a Leaf fan now? And I said, between journalism and Harold Ballard, I was cured of the habit. So.
Yep, that's the truth. I mean,
it seems like, I mean, you know, is there anybody that liked the guy? Seems like he was a very unlikable person.
He was, but at the same time, he could also be very charming and funny and entertaining. And so, not unlike professional wrestling, you know, people love the villain. And so, you know, you just love it when the villain's going to town in wrestling and really, really acting up. And you're like, yeah, this is awesome. This is awesome. And there was kind of a perverse sense of let's see what he's going to do next. You know, and as I said, he tormented poor Roger Neilson and fired him and wanted to go back out wearing a bag over his head. And, you know, just crazy stuff. It just was, it was never ending. Every day was an adventure. But I'm sure for a lot of the Leafs, it was like, you got to be kidding me. Those were, at times in the 80s, it got to be pretty grim.
Well, yeah, there's stories I've just read over the years and just reading about today, knowing we were going to bring him up, not even with the Leafs necessarily, but how he would, what he would do with the Gardens. If it was a concert, he'd shut the, you know, turn the heat up or shut the air conditioning off in June, July, and shut the water down. And like, it was crazy, just torment people for no reason.
Didn't want Russians in the building, that sort of thing. You know, touring Russian teams weren't able to come in when he was owning things.
Right. What was it like covering a game at the Gardens, Bob? Like, you know, it's, we were talking about the Gardens earlier. It was an old barn. I don't even remember the press box. Like, see, I'm trying to visually think about where it was, but what was that
like?
Well,
if you go to the Mattamy Athletic Center, which is of course where Ryerson is, it's the old Maple Leaf Gardens, and it's hard to envision because the floor, the ice surface at Mattamy would be halfway up Maple Leaf Gardens. In other words, the ice surface there would be, you know, the seats that they put in would be like the first row of the greens, and then there was the grays, and then there was the press box ran right across, and it was sort of suspended from the came out from the wall and the ceiling. But you can kind of see where the girders, you know, I could sit there because I can envision it, but you can kind of see where the girders were, that's where the press box would have been, but it's really just the concourse now. But you can look up at the roof and it's very familiar. I love going to Maple Leaf Gardens. It was, you know, the building had so much tradition. The pictures in the hallways on the concourse on the main level were fantastic. Black and white pictures and then later color. But lots of great pictures of great moments in Leaf history or Maple Leaf Gardens history. And as I said, yeah, it was just a cool place to go. And as a kid who grew up in the 60s in Toronto, to have an opportunity to go and cover games at Maple Leaf Gardens and to sit in the press box and go to the Leaf room and know that that's the same room where Teter Kennedy and so many of the great Maple Leafs played and got dressed. That was pretty special for a Scarborough kid.
You ever get into the hot stove?
Yeah, hot stove was great. And occasionally, especially when I became editor-in-chief of the Hockey News, the Hockey News had an account at the Hot Stove, and we were, quote-unquote, I guess, members. So I can remember taking my dad and my father-in-law and my brother-in-law and going to a game and going to the Hot Stove. The entrance was right on Church Street, halfway between Wood Street and Carlton. And there was a Greek gentleman. His first name was Nick. I can't remember what his last name was. And he ran the Hot Stove, and he was a great guy. And it was a fantastic place to go in and have a steak before the game and then go and take your seats and watch the game. And I didn't do it very often, Hot Stove or the ticket thing, but as I said, it was kind of neat to take my dad and my father-in-law and my brother-in-law to a game there.
Yeah, that's the one thing my dad and his buddy Jeff, they've been going to games since the early 80s. They say they miss the most is the Hot Stove. Not shockingly, just going there Saturday night after the game, he's like, it was rocking.
Yeah, it was. And you know, because think of it, in the old days, there was no Platinum Lounge. There was no, you know, I guess after at a certain time, you could actually buy beer in the rink. But even that, when I first started going there, you couldn't. It was Toronto the good in every sense of the word. If you did the hot stove, you'd have dinner there before the game, and then you could go in there during the intermission, and the same table you had dinner at, you could go in and have drinks. It was really kind of cool. So, and then post game as well too. So as your dad would tell you, post game festivities were great.
Oh yeah, they'd be rolling out onto church, and
staying deep.
Yeah, it would have been, and you'd be smoking in there and everything. It would have been.
Now then, you know, absent of that, there were a lot of other people who the routine would have been to go to, I think it was the Barbarians on Church Street, and then there was another place, Harry's.
Right.
There was a couple of really good steakhouses just stone's throw from the corner of Wood and Church.
Yeah, not exactly Harbor 60 type of decorum in those spots back in the day, I'm sure.
No, but it was still pretty cool. And you know what? And it was like, there was a pretty cool buzz in the air for a Leaf game back then. It was completely different than Montreal, and I found that out when I started to go to Montreal. Montreal had like a real kind of electricity in the air. That was the first thing I noticed, and it's really, and I always say this all the time, it's the difference between the Montreal Canadiens and the Toronto Maple Leafs, the difference between the province of Quebec and the province of Ontario, especially back then, the difference between Montreal as a city and Toronto as a city. Back in the day, Montreal, because of the French element, that's where you went for a wild weekend. Toronto was Toronto the good. You couldn't get a drink on Sunday. The only way you could get a drink on Sunday in a restaurant was if you ordered food with it. You weren't allowed to pick up your drink and go from table to table. Even in a bar, you had to sit down where your drink was, and there were all these crazy Ontario, Toronto the good, Presbyterian, you know, history of Toronto that didn't allow for any fun. And the Toronto the good was actually Toronto the boring. And Montreal was like a happening place. And the Canadians were a team that was filled with stars and just like off the charts. Maurice Richard, Jean Béliveau, Guy Lafleur, it didn't matter what era of the Montreal Canadiens you were talking about. They had these electrifying best players in the National Hockey League, all these Hall of Famers. Excuse me. And then you come to Toronto, and it was always like a bunch of workmen, Punchimlack had that, Alan Stanley and Carl Brewer and Bobby Bond and Kent Douglas. And it was always the team is greater than the sum of its parts and not very many stars, not to the same degree as Montreal. So you couldn't end up with two more diametrically opposed philosophies or atmospheres. But there was still a real reverence associated with going to a game at Maple Leaf Gardens.
Great stuff, Bob, as always, buddy. Have a great weekend. We'll do it again soon.
Awesome, boys. Have a good one.
Bob McKenzie, our Hockey Insider. That was cool, though.
It is awesome.
Talking about Harold Ballard and the Gardens.
Well, I mean, I think Bob was quite diplomatic on some things. It sounds like there's some crazy stories out there about Ballard.
Dude,
there's got to be a book, doesn't there?
Oh, there's been books, for sure.
I went down, inside knowledge
like that book is what I want. That's what I would read.
I just got caught down a rabbit hole when Bob was talking. There's a McLean's article called Sex, Sport, and Scandal, September 12th, 1988. And it's littered with, you know, all sorts of stuff here.
I'll go find that.
It looks like a partner, two Toronto millionaires, a guy named Jack Kent Cook.
Now, again,
I don't know the article and all that. It's a McLean's, so I think it's
it'd be reputable then. Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's a fact, I'm sure.
Sounds like they were up to having some fun back then.
All right, we're
How
up against
riding
it.
Riding the Zamboni naked. I love it.
Yeah, is that what he said? I thought he said that.
Yeah, he did.